AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, Brett Johnson with you here on a Tuesday afternoon. Right now we're joined by Patrick Houlihan. He is the editor-in-chief of the Minnesota Reformer, great resource to find the latest in Minnesota news and politics over at minnesotareformer.com, as we have a couple of stories we'll be talking about today in the city of Minneapolis, and we might talk a little bit too about what's happening in the special election in the 1st Congressional District. Patrick, thanks so much for joining me on the show today. Good to hear from you.
Good to be here.
Absolutely. So let's start off in the city of Minneapolis, as this is a piece Dina Winter wrote today. Minneapolis police officer Corey Taylor was on a SWAT team that drove around in an unmarked van firing rubber bullets at people without warning 5 days after the police murder of George Floyd. The officers wound up severely beating Jaleel Stallings and Virgil Lee Jackson Jr. And I bring this up because now the officer, Corey Taylor, is going to be getting a $190,000 workers' compensation settlement from the city of Minneapolis. Now, before we dive into the idea of him getting that workers' comp settlement and why he's able to get that money, let's back up a little bit. And I want to ask you, Patrick, what exactly was the role that Taylor played in the SWAT team that night when they attacked both Stallings and Jackson? And what actions did Taylor take against both of them, and specifically Jackson?
So he was in the van. It's an unmarked white van. They're driving around, and they're shooting these rubber bullets at people who are out after curfew. In this case, Stallings thought that he was hit with a real bullet, and he fired back. And that's how the crisis kind of erupts. The officer, and this officer in particular, is supposed to be covering with his rifle. They all jump out of the van, and he participates in the, I think it's on video, so we'll call it a beating of Mr. Jackson. They spent about a couple minutes beating and tasing him and telling him to comply, even though when they ran over there, he was already on his knees, on his hands, on his head. So there was no resistance there. He had not fired. He was literally just a bystander. His only crime was being out after curfew. So that is now under investigation. The entire incident is under investigation by state and federal authorities, which we broke a couple of weeks ago. And at the same time, we have all of this workers' comp claims being made. So it's an interesting juxtaposition of two different threads of reporting that Dean has been doing for the last 6 or 9 months.
Well, $190,000 seems like a lot that they're going to be paying to this officer, Corey Taylor, considering that, well, Jaleel Stallings was acquitted of basically any wrongdoing in the incident, and there's very damning video of what happened with the SWAT team that is available, and I know you guys helped break over at the Reformer. And now, of course, as you mentioned, the incident is being investigated by state and local authorities. So in light of those facts, why exactly did the city council approve that payment to Taylor? Can we go into more detail about that?
Sure. I mean, there's privacy laws that don't allow us to know exactly what the workers' comp claim is. But I can tell you that, and so we don't have access to that information, but I can tell you that we've been reporting on in the aggregate, there's been a lot of these cases, workers' comp, as well as disability retirements that are being claimed by Minneapolis police in particular since the George Floyd police killing. And the thinking on the count with the city attorney is you should just settle these cases rather than try to take them to court, where if you lose, the stakes are pretty high. You end up losing all the back pay for all those years, plus healthcare in perpetuity, which is really expensive over time. So they're settling these. And so that's one of the reasons why the Minneapolis police force has shrunk so much, because all these claims that have been made since June of 2020.
And I think the attorney does have a point that if you do drag this thing out in the court system, it could end up costing the city a lot of money. But then on the other hand, as you mentioned, with so many workers' comp claims coming through the city right now, it really does put a pretty big strain on the city's budget right now. And I imagine that's got to be raising the concern for members of the city council and also, well, residents in general of Minneapolis that, well, they look and see, well, we're paying $190,000 to this $190,000 to this officer, but yet again, we could be paying even more if we try to fight these things. So it does put the city in kind of a tough position where they have so many people leaving and they're going to end up with these massive workers' comp payments. But then again, if they try to fight that in the court system, they could end up paying even more.
Yeah, they're in a difficult situation, and the city is also self-insured. So what that means is it's not like there's an insurance company that's paying out these claims. It's just the city taxpayers who are doing it directly. So yeah, it's not an enviable position for city leadership.
Has there been a response at all from members of the city council raising concerns about this, about these payments that have been going out?
They have. I believe council member Ellison, and I think one of the newer council members as well, Jason Chavez, I think. But for the most part, other than voicing some concerns about it, any kind of momentum to decline on these because, again, the risk of losing in court.
Staying in Minneapolis now, let's go to an article that I know was written by Max Nesterak, and this has to do with, well, Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey announcing yesterday that he plans to ban all no-knock warrants in the city of Minneapolis. The announcement comes more than a month after a Minneapolis police officer shot and killed 22-year-old Amir Locke when executing a no-knock warrant, even though Locke was not the subject of that no-knock warrant. So what exactly does Frey's proposal do with no-knock warrants and really other types of search warrants that could be executed by the Minneapolis Police Department?
So he wants to ban them all, these no-knock warrants, and it would extend to other jurisdictions for Minneapolis police, as well as Minneapolis police executing for them for other agencies in the city. So no more no-knock warrants. And then also there'd be new rules on all search warrants. So there would be a 20-second wait after you knock and enter a home during the daytime and then 30 seconds at night. This is, I think, considered important because in the Locke case, I think it was 10 seconds. He was dead by the time they put they opened the door to the time that they shot Locke. So they're trying to create fewer of these kind of high risk situations. The devil will be in the details because at this point, it's just a proposal. It gets sent over to apparently the police department will actually write the policy. And then we'll have to see, what kind of exceptions there could be and how the policy is written.
Yeah, you were kind of alluding to this, but I'm curious what happens next in the process. Is Frey allowed to implement this unilaterally, or does the city council get input? I know you were saying the police are going to be involved in potentially writing this policy as well, which could raise some red flags for many folks within the city. Talk about what is the next step in the process of getting this implemented.
So in Minneapolis, the mayor does have complete authority over the police department. So the city council, as much as they've tried to wade into police policy in recent years, it's pretty clear in the charter that ultimately this is the mayor's authority, and so he gets to just implement this. I think the thought is that he put this out there to try to get support in the city before it actually becomes the policy. Of course, what really matters is are officers complying with it. I think that's it remains to be seen given what we saw from the audit last week that came out about the events following George Floyd's murder, when it just seemed like there was a lot of chaos in how government was operating.
Yeah,
city government, I should say.
Yeah, exactly. Fry was certainly the subject of criticism in that report last week that I know you guys reported on over at The Reformer. And I wonder if the response to what Fry is proposing now could be seen as maybe too little too late, especially when, well, last year during the campaign season, Fry promised that he was going to ban no-knock warrants, and that didn't happen. So curious what the response could be in the city right now, being that we had that pretty brutal report that was audit report that was released last week, and then that campaign promise from last year, which wasn't executed at least until potentially this year.
This the issue of no-knock warrants has become very difficult for him this year because it did seem that his campaign's language, as he said, became more casual and didn't reflect the necessary precision or nuance of the policy change. So they made this promise that they had gotten rid of no-knock warrants. They clearly really had not. And then Mr. Locke was killed. So it's been a real serious problem for him. And I suspect has created a lot of skepticism about the new policy.
Speaking with Patrick Coulican, editor-in-chief over at the Minnesota Reformer. Make sure you go to their website, minnesotareformer.com, for the latest in Minnesota news and politics. Let's move out of the city of Minneapolis and head down to southern Minnesota with the first congressional district election. They have a special election coming up in August to replace the late Jim Hagedorn, who passed away a few weeks ago. And one of the big names that will be entering the race on the Republican side is Jennifer Carnahan, who was the wife of Hagedorn, as Carnahan has announced that bid in CD1. Carnahan does have a checkered past, though, with allegations that she created a toxic work environment, and then, of course, her ties to Tony Lazzaro, who is on trial for attempted sex trafficking of a minor, among other charges. So I guess I want your sense on this, Patrick. How much might her past hinder her chances in that race? Because I go back to what you and I talked about last week with, for example, Corey Heppela, and how sometimes it's easy to get caught in your own bubble, whether it's a media bubble or a political bubble, and you might not be quite as well known as you originally think. And I wonder if the residents in CD1 might not know much about Jennifer Carnahan other than the fact that she was Jim Hagedorn's wife. So I'm curious what your take is on how much her past might come back to hurt her in that race.
Yeah, I mean, I can't say that I have any kind of polling or anything, but I think you've asked the right question. A source of mine pointed out this headline on Friday in Politico. This is House GOP winces as Hagedorn's scandal-plagued widow eyes his empty seat. Not the kind of headline that you want, and in the days leading up to your campaign announcement. And my response was, well, how many voters in the first are reading are reading Politico on Friday morning? How widespread is it known? And then also, how well known is this history with, the first step is going to be a convention endorsement. So, how does she probably knows a lot of these attend convention goers from her time in party politics. She was at times kind of polarizing, but she did get reelected only to party chair only 6 months before, or even very very close to the time that she was forced to resign. So does she carry that goodwill over into the convention, the goodwill for her husband? Does that carry over? And then does someone try to challenge her in the primary? Where you're going to have a bigger, a much larger pool of voters, people who have less information, and so how do they? I mean, what do they know about Jennifer Carnahan, as opposed to other than the fact that she's the widow of Jim Hagedorn? These are all unanswered questions. I do think that if she is the nominee, it's the only way that the DFL has a shot at that race, and I think that the former CEO of Hormel, Jeff Ettinger, is has announced his intention to run I think he's a strong candidate against Carnahan.
Yeah, I know Richard Painter is also in that race as well, who is at least well known among in political circles as being a former member of the Bush administration, who has now gone on to criticize President Donald Trump. So the DFL will certainly have an interesting race on their hands as well. But I want to go to the last line of the article that you guys have talking about Carnahan entering the race, and I'll just read it verbatim. A campaign spokesperson said, "Carnahan, who has previously lived in St. Louis Park, lives in Blue Earth." And I bring this up because I think of the idea of carpetbagging and having someone that maybe doesn't live in the district try to run to, well, represent a district. That idea of carpetbagging kind of does play in rural districts, so I wonder if that could be a line of attack that might be used against Carnahan, not only by the DFL, but maybe even her other potential challengers for the Republican nomination, because that does play, I think, the idea that, well, someone is trying to run in a rural district and they don't really live there or don't really have many ties.
Right. I mean, legally, she doesn't have to live there, but she is registered to vote there. I mean, there was a strong inference that they were keeping two addresses, one in the metro and one down there. I'm not going to besmirch Jennifer Carnahan's Blue Earth bona fides, but you can imagine this kind of line of attack definitely. Being used in the both Republican primary and then also in the general election.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting race to watch, especially with that tight calendar and the fact that we have a special election in August and then, well, the actual election in November with a primary in there too. So it's a very busy time down in the first congressional district. Well, you have been speaking with Patrick Houlihan, editor-in-chief of the Minnesota Reformer. Make sure you go to minnesotareformer.com for the latest in Minnesota news and politics. Patrick, thanks again for the time today. Always good chatting with you.
Good to be here.